welcome everyone. Tonight's exercise in civil discourse is very interesting and concerns us all. No one disagrees that our nation is in one of its greatest crises in most of our lifetimes. Regardless of how we arrived at this predicament, the solution out of it necessarily is political. When one observes the political process currently in Congress, the executive branch, and the Supreme Court, it's difficult to be optimistic. The current state of political affairs seems inadequate to deal with a tough reality that exists, and the average citizen seems powerless to have an impact on the outcome. Tonight's forum will focus on the political parties and some of the forces that have brought about significant ideological shift in those parties over the past several years. I would like to introduce Carolyn Stegman, who is going to go over the format for tonight's forum. Carolyn.
Hi, welcome very much, and I'm glad to see all of you here. Tonight is not a debate. It is a forum of civil discourse. Therefore, there will not be a winner and a loser. We're here to learn about different points of views and even those that differ from us. You know, in all this vitriol that's happening all around us, we want to stay civil. We believe that civil discourse is a science and that we can even talk about controversial subjects, even things that we feel passionate about in a civil way. So therefore, we are going to ask you to show respect and civility at all times, even if you disagree, and never denigrate another group or any other person. I did this in my class for 25 years teaching at Salisbury University. I made him sign a contract saying we will stay civil at all times and never denigrate any person or group, and it worked. And we actually had a freer classroom because of it. So therefore, I ask you to read over this if you have any questions. Anybody? Thank you and welcome. Now back to John.
We have a wonderful panel tonight, and I'd like to introduce the panelists. Toward me is Dr. Harry Basehart. Harry is a distinguished retired professor who's chairman of the political science department and was at the university for 37 years. And he is on the Democratic Central Committee and is a good representative for the Democratic side of things. The other panelist is Dr. David Parker. David is currently the president of the Central Committee, the Republican Central Committee here locally, and he's the chairman of the Mathematics and Computer Science Department at the university.
Passed.
Our moderator tonight is Don Rush. Everyone knows Don. He's the news director at Maryland Public Radio here locally. He's excellent, and will be able to be very civil in moderating this discussion. Don?
Well, I appreciate everybody coming out because it's probably one of the best times to have this discussion because we are, of course, watching the presidential debates take place, nominating process for both the Republicans and Democrats, and it's against a backdrop of, as he said, probably the greatest economic crisis since the Great Depression. And one of the things that really struck me is that it really creates a situation where the parties and what they believe are now in very stark relief. And we see them battling out over ideas as well as politics. I had a chance, by the way, to read Michael Hiltzik's new book on the New Deal. And what really struck me about the book and about the period of the 1930s was that I'm hearing the same arguments, same conflicts, over relief programs or assistance programs, over deficit spending, public debt, financial regulations, which are very controversial, as well as things like Social Security and the beginning of welfare. And yes, there were charges of socialism and indeed fascism all during the 1930s. So we are sort of a raucous group when it comes to Americans and how we feel about the role of the central government in particular. And I was reminded that at the founding of the country, we had both James Madison, who was president, to become president, also Alexander Hamilton, who was to become the U.S. Treasurer, got together and they put together the Federalist Papers to talk about what the Constitution meant and to sell it to the American people. And no sooner had the vote taken place and the Constitution was ratified that these two gentlemen began to squabble over just what it meant. And I think that's illustrative of the fact that we do hear a great deal about getting back to the Constitution. Perhaps our founding fathers would be a bit amused by all of that. And finally, I wanted to mention, I was watching Ron Paul the other night, who's running for president in the Republican nomination race. And he said that the Constitution, the US Constitution, was written to restrain the central government. And on one level, he's quite true. It delineates powers and responsibilities. An issue, I think, that certainly divides the two parties. Although it does contain things, sort of general statements like, you know, for the general welfare, we're not quite sure what that means, and we're still debating over that. But it also struck me that Ron Paul was also wrong, that the U.S. Constitution was actually written to strengthen the central government after the failure of the Articles of Confederation. So from the very beginning of the country, from the very inception of our founders, we have been debating this issue about the role of the central government, and we are debating it even still. So those are my remarks, and why don't we start with the Democratic side of the aisle with Harry Basehart.
Okay. Well, before I start, I know I speak for Dave, maybe the only time tonight that we agree on, but to thank John Rutenberg, Don Rush, and Susan Parker, and Carolyn Stegman, and Adam Hoffman for all getting together and finding the room and short notice and getting us all here. And of course, Dave for being here. You know, Dave and I, on faculty matters, I think we agreed about 100% over the years we've been teaching. Maybe not so much on political. We'll see. My comments will focus on political ideology from four perspectives: the Democratic Party, polarization in American politics, the 2012 presidential election, and governing. I'd like to start, however, by describing what a political ideology is, at least as I understand it, saying that political ideology is a set of beliefs and values about the nature of society, and the role of government is a usual definition and might seem to be enough of a definition, but it's really not. Beliefs and values are part of an ideology, but not a complete picture. In an ideology, beliefs must be combined, and the phrase is, with a guide to political action, where preferences on what government should do in the actual world logically follow from the beliefs and values. So before applying this definition to the Democratic Party, there is a prior question that I thought about, and that is, where do you look to find the Democratic Party's ideology? Well, the Democratic Party is made up of three parts. I learned when I was an undergraduate, I guess, really. First, elected public officials at the national, state, and local levels who run for office as Democrats and call themselves Democrats once elected. The second part is the Democratic Party organization at the national, state, and local levels, where individuals work in paid position or as volunteers. And the third part is average citizens who identify themselves as Democrats and vote for Democratic candidates on a regular basis. Consequently, there are a number of places one can go to identify the Democratic Party's ideology, including policies and statements by Democratic presidents, voting records of Democratic members of Congress, party platforms adopted at the national conventions, and public opinion surveys of Democratic voters. Well, I've done some of this in preparing a description of the Democratic Party's ideology, and although I'm not saying anything new to those in the audience or those who will be watching on PAC-14, the Democratic Party's ideology is best classified as liberal. Okay? And we agree on that. In part, a liberal ideology means that the Democratic Party sees government, national, state, and local, as having an important role in promoting fairness and advancing, as my colleague philosopher Fran Kane calls it, the public good. Democrats believe that the public good cannot be determined exclusively by the marketplace. It is a collective endeavor that should be decided through the political process. Nevertheless, saying that the Democratic Party believes government has a positive role does not mean that Democrats desire a government that has unlimited scope. For example, the party generally does not favor government's intrusion on individual civil liberties. Yes, Democrats favored a law requiring individuals to buy health insurance as a means to help everyone receive quality medical care. This is clearly a public good. On the other hand, Democrats will not support, for example, allowing the federal government to monitor telephone and email communications of Americans suspected of having terrorist ties unless a warrant has been obtained from a federal court. And let me add, although an active government is a principle of the Democratic Party, this does not mean that every Democrat in every instance will favor every governmental action or program. Even though the Democratic Party's ideology is liberal, there are Democrats who are not liberal on all issues, such as homosexuality, and according to a recent public opinion survey I looked at, even on enforcement of environmental laws and regulations. There is some ideological diversity within the Democratic Party, and at times, ideological diversity has been characterized, has characterized the Republican Party also. A new trend has emerged, and it runs counter to this traditional pattern of ideological diversity, and I want to spend some time to talk about it. This new pattern is really overpowering ideological diversity in the political parties. Political scientists have given a name, and they call it partisan ideological polarization. And all of us are aware of it. We may not have called it by that term, and I think it's probably one of the main reasons for the discussion we're having at this forum. Recent research by an Emory University political scientist has documented that citizens, especially those who are the most politically engaged, have become more ideological during the past 10 years, meaning that a larger proportion of voters are taking consistently liberal positions on issues or conservative positions on issues. Further, a stronger association between issue positions and party identification has occurred. Simply put, partisan ideological polarization means that more voters today are liberals or conservatives, and if they are liberals, they are Democrats, and if they are conservative, they are Republicans. To paraphrase political scientist Norm Ornstein of the American Enterprise Institute, imagine 1,000 voters on a football field. In the 1960s or earlier, voters would have formed the bell-shaped curve, with the majority of them near the 50-yard line, and they'd be from one sideline to the other sideline. There'd be so many of them. On today's football field, we would have fewer voters at the 50-yard line, and most of them would be down at one goalpost or the other. And we don't have time to talk about the many causes of polarization, but the underlying cause has been the realignment, which started in the late 1960s, of white Southern voters from the Democratic Party to the Republican Party. Voters in the South who were conservative Democrats for decades have become Republicans, a party where their beliefs were a better fit. Similar but smaller changes happened in the Midwest and Northeast, where voters moved from liberal Republicans to Democrats. Again, a party better suited for their political beliefs. Well, so with this background, I'd like to look at the 2012 election and at how we can describe American citizens, not just Democrats, in terms of ideology. Now, I know that there was a recent Gallup survey that found that conservatives outnumber liberals by 2-1 in the United States. 40% conservatives, 21% liberals, 2-1 among the general public. So this is pretty good news for Dave. But keep in mind two things about this Gallup survey. That 2-1 margin has been that way for at least 20 years. You look at it over time, and in fact, it's a little less now than it was 20 years ago. And keep in mind that Gallup's analysis is based on asking one question, and the question is, how would you describe your political views? Very conservative, conservative, moderate, liberal, or very liberal? One question. A better approach is the one taken by the Pew Research Center for the People and the Press. Based on a 2011 national survey, Pew researchers present an intriguing classification of voters. They call it a political typology. And it's really designed to highlight differences within the parties. But if you look at the data, you can pretty easily infer what differences between the parties are. And let me just spend a little time on this. Approximately 9% of the general public, according to Pew, is classified as staunch conservatives. They are extremely Republican. They're strongly conservative on almost every issue. Staunch conservatives believe a number of things. Stricter environmental laws and regulations cost too many jobs and hurt the economy. They believe that government is almost always wasteful and inefficient, and that the best way to ensure peace is through military strength, and they oppose gay marriage. Again, these are just a few things. Now, solid liberals make up 14% of the general public. They are strongly democratic. They have liberal positions on almost every issue. They believe good diplomacy is the best way to ensure peace, that government regulation of business is necessary to protect the public interest, and that government often does a better job than people give it credit for. And they also believe that homosexuality should be accepted by society. Again, these are just a few things. Although it's probably an oversimplification, it has been noted by many observers that conservatives oppose government regulation on economic issues, but they're willing to support government regulation in the area of social and moral issues. And liberals are the opposite. They favor government regulation on economic matters and oppose government regulation in the area of social and moral issues. Now, I mention this because I wanted to say a word about libertarians. Libertarians, according to this Pew survey, make up about 10% of the public, and they are unique because they combine the, as you probably know, they combine the conservative position of no government regulation on economic issues and the liberal position of no government regulation on social issues. Now, I know there's a Libertarian Party, but libertarians tend to identify as independence-leaning Republican or Republican. They are not Democrats, as you probably know. Now, this leaves over 50% of the public that tends to have more middle-of-the-road or moderate positions. So, in looking at this in terms of the 2012 election, it seems to me that the ideological picture may be complex, but I don't see that it disadvantages the Democratic Party in 2012. What may be more challenging to the Democratic Party is that discontent in the nation remains high. 3 of every 4 citizens feel angry or frustrated with the federal government, for example. Still, even with this challenge, when specific issues are examined, which will most likely decide the 2012 election, Democrats are in a good position with voters on many issues. Two examples, the party's position that the best way to handle the federal budget deficit is a combination of cutting domestic and defense spending and increasing taxes is supported by nearly two-thirds of the public. And although the public disagrees about the evidence for global warming, almost two-thirds agree with the Democratic Party's position that the more important energy priority is to develop alternative energy sources such as wind, solar, and hydrogen. Well, my final comments concern a question that follows, I think, from the way John Rutenberg framed the topic for this forum, and it is this. Do Democrats, once elected, govern as liberals? And I suppose the same thing could be asked of Republican presidents, too. I will try to answer a more focused version. Has President Obama followed liberalism in governing? My answer is yes, but a qualified yes. Of course, the best example of President Obama governing as a liberal is the Affordable Care Act passed by Congress and signed into law by the President in March of 2010. This act expands health insurance coverage, as you know, to the uninsured and makes other improvements in the healthcare system. It is a major accomplishment that has eluded liberals and Democratic presidents for close to 50 years. On the environment, he has adopted dramatic new fuel efficiency standards for vehicles and promoted new technologies that allow some cars and trucks to run solely on renewable energy. Again, following the liberal view that stricter environmental laws and regulations are worth the cost. In foreign policy, President Obama has tracked the liberal view that the U.S. should take into consideration the interest of its allies when making foreign policy decisions. He did this last March by backing NATO airstrikes in Libya to support rebel troops in overthrowing Muammar Gaddafi. And at the same time, he rejected putting American combat units on the ground in Libya. Now, for many liberal Democrats, what I see as evidence of the governor's liberal, they see as disappointments. That is not being liberal enough. They would say on health care that President Obama never really supported a single-payer system and generally compromised too much with conservatives. On the environment, they would say he pulled back a proposed EPA clean air regulation aimed at reducing health-threatening smog and caved in to protecting businesses and congressional Republicans. On foreign policy, they would say using NATO to conduct military action in Libya was really inappropriate use of military force, just as it was wrong not to end military involvement in Afghanistan. Well, my response to disappointed liberals is this. It's not easy to govern in the United States and adhere to an ideology. And there are a couple reasons, probably more than that, but two I want to mention. First, conditions a president faces may change, requiring an adjustment in priorities. As an example, to accelerate an economic recovery from a worse-than-expected recession, a president may decide that new environmental regulations have to be delayed. A second reason is the nature of our presidential congressional system of government. A precondition for a Democratic president's success with Congress is Democratic majorities in the House of Representatives and the Senate. Regrettably, this type of unified government, as usually what it's called, is the exception. Since 1981, the presidency and Congress have been controlled by the same party for only 8 years, or four Congresses, 8 years. Divided government, where one party controls the presidency and the other party controls one or both houses of the Congress, is far more typical. 24 years of divided government since 1981. And even with unified government, a president may still have to make compromises to move major programs through Congress, especially in the Senate, where ending a filibuster, as you know, takes 60 votes. And everything is filibustered. Perhaps the most successful Democratic president in dealing with Congress in the last 50 years was Lyndon Johnson. Johnson was elected president in 1964 in one of the largest popular vote margins in the history of American elections. And he had long coattails, helping to elect Democrats to both houses of Congress. The Congress that convened in the Capitol in 1965 became one of the great reform Congresses in American history. Significant legislation was passed, including Medicare and Medicaid, the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, and the Voting Rights Act. The Democratic Party did not have just a simple majority in 1965 and 66. Rather, it had a sizable two-thirds of the members in each house, the House and the Senate, two-thirds of the members. And Democrats had 68 seats in the Senate, compared with Obama's for his first 2 years of 60 in the Senate. My point is this. It takes a supermajority in the United States to govern and follow an ideology consistently. Those are my comments. I just want to end with one other thing, if I may. I ran across a survey question that asked American citizens what kind of politicians they want. They want politicians or elected officials who stick to their positions over those who make compromises with people they disagree. Stick to their positions or make compromise with people who disagree. Overall, a majority of citizens, I wouldn't say it's substantial, but a majority of citizens say they want elected officials who stick to their principles. Well, in thinking about this, in part, you know, we've met the enemy and he's us. Because we want our politicians to stick to principles, and it's and in our constitutional system, it can be very, very difficult. I'll stop there.
So we'll hear from the Republican side of the aisle, Dave Parker.
Well, I have to be. I agree with most of what you said, Harry. I have to be respectful. My parents always taught me to respect my elders, and Harry is 1 year, 1 month, and exactly 2 weeks senior to me. I'm going to comment on Libya, though. A rather liberal member of Congress, Kucinich, actually indicated that the president exceeded his powers under the War Powers Act with Libya and said it was an impeachable offense several times. We definitely have an interesting situation in Congress. Okay, when I was growing up, I recall occasionally hearing about Democrats and Republicans arguing vigorously in the U.S. Congress. But I also recall something else. They were respectful of each other, and on many occasions, friends. Two senators from opposite sides of the aisle could very easily be photographed with their wives, it was wives almost always, I hope, having dinner together in a Washington restaurant, sharing a meal, laughing, having a good time, because they had so much respect for each other. They could disagree, and they were not disagreeable. They had different views. That is not the case today, and that's part of our problem. Casting aspersions upon an opponent's motives is commonplace. Demonizing entire groups is all too frequent, and this behavior is not limited to one party. But I'm more sensitive to attacks coming at me and mine than those directed from my side toward others. I'm more sensitive to those that come at me. For example, anyone who criticizes President Obama runs the risk of being labeled publicly a racist, even if the issue involves a matter of philosophical or political belief. The Tea Party was completely and unfairly labeled as a bunch of homophobic, gun-toting racists. The Tea Party Republicans in the House were called terrorists and hostage takers by Democrat leaders. Many of these attacks occurred long after the president himself called for civility. Will anyone argue that these attacks have any part of civility in them? They certainly do nothing to make meaningful compromise possible, particularly as Harry pointed out, the voters expect people to stick by their principles. Beginning about the 10th grade, it goes back a few years, I began listening to the radio and TV, watching TV, and reading local paper in Manhattan, Kansas, and also the Kansas City papers. That's what my parents got. There wasn't much else. But I was really impressed by the fairness and objectivity of the journalists who recorded everything from around the world. I can no longer say that. Either I've gotten older or things have changed. I think things have changed. The Fourth Estate once performed an incredibly valuable function by helping to keep politicians honest. But such fairness has become almost extinct. There are way more commentators and fewer real journalists. We have to be careful what we read. Opinion is mixed in with fact. Very much confusing the meaning of what we're reading. I was a little slow to catch on, actually. It was not until the 2000 butterfly ballot and hanging Chad mess in Florida that I clearly recognized obviously biased reporting. It's only gotten worse. Anybody remember Rathergate? But to return to tonight's main topic, there are some specific issues which I believe Democrats and Republicans had different philosophical approaches, and I'd like to briefly address several of them, as Harry did. I do not mean to imply that all Republicans believe one way or all Democrats the other, for most of us have some kind of a smorgasbord of beliefs in between. Also, the Republican Party is very much now influenced by the Tea Party, which is an interesting mix of Republicans, mostly, Democrats, and independents. In fact, I think more independents than Democrats, hard to say. They don't identify themselves that way. I'll start with illegal immigration. May as well take an easy topic. Republicans definitely want the border sealed, but it seems apparent that many Democrats do not. Republicans are typically opposed to providing anything other than emergency medical care to illegals. Democrats generally want to provide them with all social services, including Social Security. It's been exciting in California watching them go under, and we're not far behind. Republicans typically do not want to reward illegals with a path to citizenship, noting how unfair this would be to those who are here legally. Republicans want immigrants to learn and use English, believing our society is still a melting pot, not a bunch of standalone immigrant groups speaking only their own languages among themselves. I admit I'm biased. I'm a Canadian American. And I've watched throughout my life as the separatist Quebec get closer and closer and closer to achieving secession. They have two languages in Canada, and they're still falling apart. Many of the prime ministers of Canada have been from Quebec. It doesn't matter. There is an incredible cultural difference there, and it's very hard to separate. They are not a melting pot. They are two loosely joined groups, at least in my opinion. We should learn from our friends to the north. Of course, I'm biased again. The role of government. Republicans almost all believe what Reagan said. Government has become too large and is doing things that are completely outside its constitutional powers. And they view big government as the problem, whereas most Democrats believe big government is the solution to the problems. Many of the disagreements follow from this simplistic approach and belief about the differences. The Constitution, Harry mentioned that. Tea Party Republicans and Tea Party Democrats, and Tea Party people, and particularly believe that the federal government should follow the strict guidelines in the Constitution. Whereas Democrats typically believe in a living, ever-changing constitution which can be freely interpreted as needed to accomplish whatever they want. New rights, for example, not found in the Constitution, are added every year, and they all cost a great deal of money. Another issue along this line is the role of activist judges. Republicans are particularly concerned that judges not make law. That is the role of Congress. And yet, we have seen over the last about 60 years, I guess, the judges getting more and more involved in particularly social issues and making law. Congress could make the same laws, they could overturn those decisions, but they've chosen not to. Strict constructionist judges are typically appointed by Republican presidents, although what was her name that Bush tried to appoint, his friend? It doesn't always work that way. Again, neither party's got clean hands on this. Voting rights. Republicans want every citizen to be able to vote. Consequently, they want to be certain that only citizens register to vote. And those who vote should present ID to show they are the people they claim they are. Unfortunately, beginning under the motor voter laws, in some states, Maryland is an example, illegal aliens can secure valid driver's licenses and have, that are just like yours and mine. And then they can register to vote, and they have. I don't know if they voted. Moreover, without even a modest ID check at the polls, dead people, people who have left the state, and others can easily cast votes, even though they're not there. Remember Cook County? There were more votes cast in Cook County in the Kennedy win, I think, than there were registered voters. Kind of wild. Present Maryland laws and regulations make catching this type of fraud almost impossible. And there are a number of groups acting to do that outside the political system. Taxes. President Obama was completely correct on several occasions when he stated that raising taxes during a recession would only make it worse. So why, if that's what he believes, has he and the Democrat Party continued to propose tax increases? That was a sticking point in the last round of negotiations. President Kennedy cut taxes, and the economy recovered quickly. Of course, they killed him, but you can't have everything. We have not cut taxes, and this recession is dragging on and on. Hopefully only on and on, not on and down. I understand the theory of why cutting taxes stimulates the economy and produces jobs. I do not understand how raising taxes does anything except the opposite. And I would argue that history is on my side. I've had discussions with people about this. I'd enjoy more. I just don't understand the argument about raising taxes to improve the economic situation. Then there's Washington speak. Every federal department expects an automatic increase of around about 7% its annual budget. It counts on it. It builds it. Consequently, if you get less than 7%, for example, the same as you had the year before, that's called a budget cut. That's Washington speak. Not allowing the so-called Bush tax cuts to expire is called lowering taxes. You see, they'd go up if you didn't take this action, therefore we're cutting taxes. Passing bills in secret and informing the Congress that they have to pass a bill in order to find out what it occurred, what's in it, that's called transparency. We gotta speak English. Why do we as voters tolerate this? Right now it's Democrats who are acting this way, but the Republicans don't have clean hands. Can we not demand a return to civility and honest use of meaningful language? Should we not, as voters, demand that our elected representatives speak clearly and honestly about what they are doing and why? We should not have to parse every sentence in order to figure out what the meaning of is, and we do. So that's where we are. I see significant differences, possibly irreconcilable ones, between the two parties on the role of the Constitution, the size of government, federal spending, and deficit taxation, voting rights, I guess a host of other matters. I didn't bring up gay marriage, so I don't think it's critical. Mention a couple others, defense, education. Those are big issues for Republicans. Every time I listen to a debate in the GOP primary, I ask myself, why are they being asked all these silly questions unless the object is to get the participants to argue and fight rather than inform the voters? Which candidate was it that said he wanted to get rid of, Perry. Energy, education, EPA. A lot of duplicate stuff there. A lot of stuff that affects the economy adversely, and they have grown. The Department of Energy is one of my favorite examples. They were created, I believe, in 1973, And their purpose was to make us less dependent on foreign oil and to increase the use of non-fossil fuels and alternative energy sources. Since that time, our dependence on foreign oil has tripled or quadrupled. They didn't succeed there. After a brief bit of support of solar energy, it fizzled out, and we are more dependent on fossil fuels now than we were when they were created, yet they receive billions of dollars every year. And we keep funding them. And you gotta ask why. There is the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, it's part of them, and I don't understand what they do, but they keep getting big increases too, and yet we haven't built a nuclear power plant, what, 40 years? It's been a long time. We waste a lot of money over there. And that swamp, or what used to be a swamp, that's now Washington, D.C. Yeah, I think it still is a swamp. At any rate, that concludes my remarks. Harry and I are glad to answer questions. We won't fight, we won't argue.
I agree
with most of what he said.
I could tell. People were given cards with questions, if we could have those collected. And Harry, I know I saw you writing furiously, so why don't you go ahead and have some comments in response to some of what Dave said.
Well, I don't know which one to take first. I don't know, on the Constitution and the activist judges and the living Constitution and the original document, you're right. That is a difference between Democrats and Republicans. Generally, although I'm always reminded of that line that an activist judge is one who makes a decision that you don't agree with.
Right.
And I think there is some truth to that. But I do think an independent judiciary is important. I don't like all of the decisions any court has made. I mean, there are specific decisions that I would not, but I still think we need an independent judiciary. Otherwise, we're going to accept what the Congress and President do as the interpretation of the Constitution. And sometimes I think conservatives think they want that, but maybe they really don't, because if that's the case, then if we had a court that was very weak, was not independent, they could not overturn if they do. I don't know what the court's going to do on the health care, in particular the individual mandate. Other because Congress and the President have already said that's it, and that's how we interpret the Constitution. So so I think that's one area where I do disagree. Dave wants to respond.
Dave, you want to respond at all? Or
I'm not sure I disagree as much, so I have a slightly different take on it. We definitely need an independent judiciary, and the three branches of government, the way our Constitution is set up, I'm concerned right now that the executive is taking too much power from both the judicial and the legislative branches, personally. I would like to see a little more balance. It may take judicial action in order to restore that. There's always friction back and forth, and of course the famous case of stuffing the Supreme Court or get a decision overturned. That's not going to end. The good news is, for some reason, we as Americans have accepted the fact that the court can determine if something is unconstitutional or constitutional, and we tend to live with it, even when they change their mind 50 years later.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't tend to go to the streets and scream and burn down buildings over it. It does provide a certain stability. And knowing you can go to the court and get some kind of a decision seems to help. I think we're lucky there. So I don't disagree, and I don't like all the opinions either.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that Obama is taking any more power than other presidents by any means. I know conservatives will frequently say, well, Obama's making these recess appointments. The Congress, the Senate has been holding up these appointments, and the Republicans have been doing it in large numbers. But you have an administration, and you have to run your administration. That's what you're elected to do. Now, I know that Democrats did that too. I don't think as frequently as the Republican Senate is doing it with Obama. But I can't think that this recess appointment is something to fear is a growth of presidential power. I mean, you have to have an administration. You have to run it.
Of course, you're talking about a Democrat Senate.
Well,
they do have 60 members. So
they don't have 60 members now.
They can conduct hearings and approve these appointments.
If it wasn't that there was a threat of filibuster to hold them up, so I disagree with that.
Well, let me intervene here, because, well, just a couple of, one of the questions I really have for Dave, and that is that, as I've watched the Republican Party, particularly over the last 30 or 40 years, even 50 years, I seem to see a change. No longer are, at least typical, are moderate Republicans, for example. The Rockefeller wing has now disappeared. Gerald Ford, one of the last probably moderate Republican presidents, put him in office vice president, certainly had to jettison him. So you did acquire, as it were, the southern vote. African Americans left the party in droves. You took on, during the late 1970s, social Christian conservatives. And you now have, in the mid-1990s, a move towards a much stronger criticism of the federal government and its role than perhaps you have in the past. I guess one of the questions I have is where your party is going, because in the current, for instance, healthcare debate, the discussion of mandates, for example, that was a Republican and conservative idea that came out of the 1990s. Mitt Romney, who's running for president, said this might be a good idea. Now suddenly it's an anathema. Where is the party going? I mean, it seems to be shifting further and further, so that the few moderates we have, for instance, in Maine, that's about it. What's your sense? I want to get your reaction to it.
I know where the moderates are now. They really seem to be located in the party structure at the national level, particularly, that Harry described in the three parts of the Democrat Party, the same in the Republican Party. That's where they seem to be located. They seem to be functioning there. And they are quite distraught, I understand, with the rightward or the conservative-leaning nature of the rank and file. Where are we going? Beats the heck out of me. I mean, I grew up in Kansas, a Goldwater conservative. A Conscience of a Conservative was the first political book I read, and I thought, man, that is me. And then I became a Republican. Probably the Republicans look upon the best president in, not probably, if not in history in recent times, Republican president, being Ronald Reagan. I don't know. I was a Democrat then, and I really didn't pay attention to him. Later I've learned what he said and did, and I'm very significantly impressed. But he shook up the Republican establishment, if you will, the core or the group in the middle, the moderates, and he took a staunch conservative position on everything, just about, and he won overwhelmingly. He wasn't hurt by the fact that Jimmy Carter was a little bit weak, but he won re-election overwhelmingly too. Conservatives point to that and say, see, that works, be true to your principles, take a stand. Coming to the middle means the parties look alike, which they both looked alike to me. Mm-hmm. When I was growing up, I couldn't tell the difference between conservatives and liberals.
Well, let me ask you this, and I want to continue, because it does seem to me that the party's moved away from Ronald Reagan even further. I mean, Ronald Reagan, for instance, cut the deal when it came to Social Security, for example. Now we're talking about privatization. We're talking about privatization, for instance, of Medicare. It seems as if there is a trend to push back many of the decisions that were made in the 20th century for particularly social programs, and I'm wondering whether that's where your party is going.
Could be. I think the bigger issue right now are things like the deficit and its role. How can we continue to borrow money, increase the national debt more and more and more? Obama was absolutely correct when he said on numerous occasions, including after he was elected, that having this debt hurts our economy, it hurts our currency, and it's going to be paid for by our children and grandchildren, and it's wrong. And I guess in January after he was elected, he pledged to cut the debt in half by the end of his first term. A few weeks later, he submitted a budget that added $1.5 trillion to the debt. I pay attention to what people do, not what they say.
Harry, you were going to say something.
Yeah, I was just going to say, you know, your original question, Don, could also be asked to me because, you know, the moderate and conservative Democrats are disappearing also, and that is it is troubling. And I remember a comment made by our former congressman, Democratic Congressman Frank Cradiville, earlier this year, where he said, you know, there's there's no way, I think he's right, there's no way the Democrats are going to get the House of Representatives back unless they can elect some moderate Democrats. And that was what they did in 2008, and then they lost in 2010, and I think that's right. And trying to draw district lines so you're going to elect all liberal Democrats, I think is a mistake.
Well, let me press you on that, Harry, because one of the things that came out of the 1980s and into the 1990s with President Bill Clinton was the development of the New Democrat, a moderate move to the center. The free trade deals, for instance, was a move to the center. Welfare reform was a move to the center. And even when you look at President Obama, you see that, for instance, the regulations, for instance, the financial regulations, are fairly moderate in their scope. And as we said a moment ago, we even go ahead.
I understand that. And I guess I'm thinking more of members of mm-hmm. Congress. I mean, I don't think they're there. Now, if you're saying that President Obama is moderate, I think he is.
We have a question here about Citizens United. It just says, how is Citizens United not making law, I assume by the judiciary? And I was kind of curious about what both of your reactions to a Citizens United decision, especially as it has now played out in the presidential election, and particularly the Republican side of the presidential election, where you have super PACs spending millions of dollars, not even controlled by the candidates. Either one of you can start. Dave?
I don't want to step in that one.
But what has it done to the political process, do you think?
Well, really a broader question is, what have these PACs done to the political process? When we so-called reformed the process, we created a new way for money to be spent, special interest groups. And I've been active in Republican politics now since about 2000. I've watched the PACs come in and do some really dastardly things on both sides. Virtually unregulated, uncontrolled, lies, just outright lies. And so I don't pay attention to them as well as I probably should. Citizens United is one of those that I'm gonna watch, but there are others out there that scare me, and
Who scares you?
Let me leave that one alone too. I mean, they're on both sides.
Harry, what do you think about Citizens United?
I don't like the unlimited, almost unlimited amounts of money coming in. I mean, there's always been an enormous amount, at least in recent elections, just almost an obscene amount. There'll be more this year. I hope that some of it balances out a little bit. But I think one of the problems we have is that no one recently, and certainly including President Obama, have talked about some need for major political reforms. And the idea of trying to reform some of these things, although it would be hard with the Supreme Court decision. I mean, our election campaigns are, it's going on. They go on and on and on. No wonder people get tired, but no one looks at how we could reform our system. And I guess because it would not be a sexy political issue, and everybody seems to get most of the money they want to do what they want, and so it goes on. So I don't know when that will end. And if somebody has a solution of how we can get around to talking about some of these political reforms that I think are needed, I mean, I'd love to hear it.
Yeah, one of the dumbest ones from my point of view would be the direct election of the president, because if that had happened, we still have the 2000 election in the courts. Every single vote in every single precinct in every single state would have been contested and fought, and it had been the legal system, and no matter who won, we would still be in trouble. One of the nice things about the electoral system is you can pretty quickly figure out who won, except for maybe a couple states. It narrows it down to a manageable number to deal with. A direct election would be a catastrophe. I speak that from a statistical point of view as well. It would be a mess. I want to go back to one other thing, though. An interesting thing politically has been the way the South has changed, the traditional South, because President Johnson got the Voter Act passed in spite of the Southern Democrats. because the Republicans agreed with him.
That's true.
And they were able to defeat the Southern Democrats. The Southern Democrats somehow got over that and joined the Republicans. It took about 15 years, but they did.
Well, let me make that observation about that, because two things happened. One is that Goldwater, as a matter of fact, voted against the Civil Rights Act and emphasized states' rights, which led to him actually breaking the solid Southern South. The second thing, however, is that the Republican Party also created in its wake an Operation Dixie, which went after that white segregationist vote.
Yep.
And they did come over to the Republican side. At the same time, Democrats then, the African Americans then finally made their move over to the Democratic side. Do you think it's been a loss for you? I mean, what do you think about that happening to your party, the Party of Lincoln?
It's an interesting historical series of events, and I'm intrigued by it. I've read a lot about it, and I've read different points of view on it, and it isn't altogether clear exactly who was doing what the strategy was. There are a lot of people who make a lot of suggestions about what they think the strategy was. It's intriguing to me the way it worked out. No one expected it to work out the way it did.
Although maybe perhaps Lyndon Johnson, who allegedly said that he expected to lose the South.
Yeah, but he wanted to get the legislation through.
That's
he
right.
He was a wheeler dealer, and he did it. I think it's intriguing, though, that it was the Republicans that made the cut there to get the Voter Rights Act passed. And now we've turned it all around. I mean, again, if Republicans say, I think we ought to show ID at the polls, they say, you want to disenfranchise people. Hell no. We just want to make sure the people voting are the voters. I want every voter to vote, but I want to make sure it's really the voters.
Harry, that's
somehow controversial.
What do you think about that switch? I mean, we've had this sort of switch. Yeah. I mean, that's a dramatic shift.
I don't know that I would label it quite as going after the segregationist vote. And I'm sure race was definitely part of it. There's no doubt about that. It's also, I think, just a more conservative ideology of limited government, and
change of the
parties. I've forgotten the name of Phillips' book on the Southern strategy. I mean, but it was a conscious effort to do it. What can I say? That's politics. I mean, it does. Things like that happen.
It's like sausage.
I mean, they were not going to. White Southerners were certainly dissatisfied with the Democratic Party and really weren't going to stay with it. And that's where they went.
Let me ask you. I have a couple of questions in regard to their social issues. One is said that neither of you have mentioned abortion, which obviously is a divider. One of the observations we make about the Republican primary, at least, is that we seem to be shifting now even away from abortion on the conservative side to talking about a personhood amendment, which could affect actual birth control. And we also have gay rights. We have the repeal, obviously, of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and gay marriage is expected certainly to come up here in the state of Maryland. How do you see these two issues playing out in terms of social conservative issues and dividing the party? Dave, what do you think? I know you didn't want to emphasize too much, but yeah, go ahead.
I'll walk on this one. I still have this one. I think most Republicans are opposed to gay marriage, but I know a lot of Republicans who are pro-abortion. That's not an issue that says if you're pro-abortion, anti-abortion, you're Republican or Democrat. That's not one of those that cuts that way. It just isn't. I suspect most Republicans, or the majority of Republicans, say, are opposed to federal funding of abortion or government funding of abortion. But that's not the same issue. And that's not the issue being discussed anymore. I mean, it's gotten out of control.
Again, as you sort of indicated, at least parenthetically, that there's a diversity of opinion in the Democratic Party on this, but I think there's no doubt that the Democratic, if we could finally say, here's the Democratic Party. They're going to believe in a woman's right to choose. They're certainly going to believe in contraception. And And gay marriage, at least civil unions. I mean, there's no doubt on those social and those social issues, moral issues, that's where the Democratic Party, not every Democrat, but where the Democratic Party's position would be.
I think Republicans believe in civil unions.
Some.
Most, again, it's the marriage they don't like.
Although I understand that the public opinion polls see that shifting towards the idea of gay marriage. My question would be, where does that put the Republican Party if public opinion is shifting? For Don't Ask, Don't Tell is another one where Republicans opposed. I mean, we seem to be getting this movement. Either one.
But I don't think the social issues are going to be the key issues in this election. You know, sometimes
right.
they are. I don't think this time they are. So I have a feeling that in terms of the outcome of that election, they're probably not going to determine the votes. Now, immigration, I think that's another one. That's a little different issue. That may determine some votes. But the traditional social moral issues, I don't think.
I agree. Are gonna be that. It's the economy and big issues. The illegal immigration issue is tied to the economy. A lot of Maryland's economy, a lot of its expenditures are for the support of illegals. And California is going to raise taxes and increase spending this year, in part because of the social services provided to illegal aliens. They're going to try. I don't know if they're going to do it or not. And I had one of my children in school in California, and another one lives there too. They both live there. And I am astonished when I read about what's going on in California. Even more so than I am astonished what goes on in Maryland. The belief that they can simply keep spending and raising taxes and spending and raising taxes, and it's all for the good of everybody, it's going to work out, everything's going to be fine. And they are looking into the abyss. And all it would take is a little push, like Greece going under, and they're done.
Well, let me ask you this.
On immigration, most Democrats agree with Newt Gingrich.
Which is?
Well, Newt Gingrich has said, if an illegal immigrant family has lived in the United States for a number of years and they're contributors to the community and they pay taxes and they have a job and they're working, they're trying to get ahead, then they should have some pathway to citizenship. At least that's how I understand the Newt Gingrich. I may have put a little spin on it, but
if he ends up being the candidate, you see, would he win Democrat votes for that reason?
Well, it's a matter of fact, because I wanted to ask you, because we have only a minute here, but particularly Dave on the immigration issue. It's close to that issue is close to the Hispanic community. If it's a close election, could affect how the Hispanic population votes. Some suggested it could be adverse to the Republican Party, the kind of positions, not Gingrich's, but the other positions that are being taken.
The legal Hispanic immigrants do not favor the illegal immigration. Many of them have family members and others who are in the process of getting legal citizenship. And some of those studies are just wrong. The situation in Maryland does not reflect the nation. And so, again, a lot of surveys are done. And how you gather information from the survey is very, very risky. And unless I can read the questions, the order they were given, and find out how they were asked, how the survey was conducted, I don't believe the damn things. And the reason is, it is so easy to manipulate the results.
Although your party is still at the best is what, 40% that they get George W. Bush, who was sympathetic to immigration? I mean, you're losing something somewhere in the voting booth, right? You think?
I was critical of George W. Bush, so he wasn't a perfect president by any means.
Talking about taxes, and we've discussed a little bit about this, but maybe we can get into a little bit more. The question is, when has lowering taxes stimulated the economy? The questioner says historically it hasn't happened. I sort of interject here that there are actually two philosophies here. One is a supply-side economics in which you cut taxes and attempt to also certainly reduce government spending. but it's to stimulate both demand as well as investment. There's also Keynesian economics, which favors both tax cuts as well as increased government spending. One of the interesting things I found, by the way, looking at the record of the Reagan administration, was they actually did both. They cut taxes, they did raise them a little later on during the recession, and they did a big tax cut. But they also had a good deal of deficit spending from, to the point of tripling, actually, the national debt. So those are the economic parameters. So the question is, when has lowering taxes stimulated the economy? And I suppose the same thing could be said for government spending, either one of you.
Well, I think when you're in a recession, it's different than when economic times are good. And I think we've thrown out a little bit about Obama raising taxes and cutting taxes, whatever, all this kinds of stuff. But I think the key is demand, and that's why the middle class tax cut is so important, and that's why the 3.2% cut in the payroll tax, which was netted around $1,000 a year, is so important because that's going to help the middle class, and they get that money, they're going to spend it. Now, talking about raising taxes, I don't think Obama has said that I can recall raising taxes on the middle class at this time, but he certainly has said that people who make incomes at a certain level, maybe a millionaire or what, maybe we do need to raise taxes there. I mean, he's under the pressure here of people wanting to cut spending, but yet if we just purely cut spending, demand is going to go down in the economy. So it's a fine line, and I think the idea of keeping taxes as low as possible, or at least having a small tax cut for the middle class, is a good idea. And on the other hand, we still don't want to cut spending so much that we're harming the social safety net, and so we may need to try to increase some taxes so we can get some revenue coming in and increase taxes on people who can afford to pay more. And I don't even think it's necessarily millionaires. I should probably check with my wife, but I think we could probably pay a few more in taxes. I mean, we could do that, and we're far from millionaires.
Millionaires' tax wouldn't generate enough revenue to do very much, unfortunately, unless you really took a lot of their money. If you took it all, it still wouldn't do enough. When has it happened? Well, Kennedy did it, but it doesn't happen overnight. The economy recovers, and the result is the two economic theories look at the same evidence and say, see, I was right. The only problem is I don't understand the Keynesian theory. I don't understand why they think it works. The supply side people generally believe that the depression was continued longer than it had to be by what the government did. The Keynesians say, no, they pulled us out of the recession, out of the depression. And they look at the same evidence and draw opposite conclusions. The problem is, if you look at it with a biased view, you can find the evidence to support your position. What I saw happen was when Reagan did cut taxes, a year and a half to 2 years later, we began to see an increase in tax revenue. It takes a bit of time for that to have an effect. And guess who benefited? The next president. And he gets the credit then for that. But he didn't do it. It was caused by Reagan. And that's what happens. If somebody does something stupid and causes a recession to start, it happens in a couple of years. I've always maintained that we could have spent a lot less money, that is, borrowed less money, if we'd say cut the federal income tax in half for 2 years. And given all of us at the bottom money to spend in our paychecks, that would have cost less than what we did by bailing out the banks and all that kind of stuff. The banks have been bailed out by us because we would have paid our mortgages, we would have paid our bills and all that. And I can understand how that might have stimulated the economy and gotten us going again. Instead, there was some kind of an interesting trickle-down theory at work here about we'll pay off all the AIG and all the big places, and somehow that will help the people at the middle and the bottom. And that trickle-down economics, I thought, had been pretty much given up on and certainly criticized by the Democrats. That's what it looked like to me. At any rate, these aren't pure systems. And it's a very, very complex thing, an economy. And it is made up of many, many parts. And anyone who comes along and says, if you do this thing, this will fix it, is either an idiot or a liar. It's too complex. It's got to be more than that. My general feeling, though, is raising taxes will slow an economy down. That's generally the economic principle. If it's getting too hot, like there's inflation, you raise taxes to slow it down a little bit, and you lower taxes to speed it up a little bit. That's generally what economists believe, but not all of them. Grab your economist and believe what you want. It's a theory. And the Nobel Economics Prize has been won by both sides, so obviously they don't know what they're doing.
Harry, what do you think?
Looking at this particular economic downturn that we're in now, that everybody recognizes as being the most severe since the Depression of 1929, and I think there's several reasons for that. One of the important ones, and one why we are not responding as quickly as we did, say, in the 80s or even in the late 1950s in that recession, is because we no longer have the manufacturing jobs that we used to have. And that's something that I think needs to be discussed more. It is discussed some, but there are, I'm sure, short-term solutions and longer-term solutions about manufacturing in America. I think we need, to have a strong middle class, we need some good manufacturing jobs in the United States.
I agree with you. We can't just have service jobs.
We can't just have service jobs. And we know we cannot all be financiers. We know that doesn't work.
As political parties, how do you get jobs, manufacturing jobs, back into the United States, given the globalization of the economy?
It's very hard. President Obama has been talking in the past couple of weeks about insourcing. Apparently, there are a few manufacturers, American manufacturers, that have manufacturing abroad, and they have been, a couple of them have moved back to the United States. So, and I think he wants to encourage that with tax credits. Then, of course, the other thing I often mentioned is currency. Evaluation. China's being at the low, and of course that makes their products cheaper here. So I think the parties, that would be very tough to do to try to get that. I mean, I think both Bush and Obama have tried to do that. But I think it's something that needs a great deal of thought, and I think the idea of insourcing where you can. Most of the stuff I read shows that if something is rather complex to manufacture, and one example I read about the other day was aftermarket fuel injectors for automobiles. And the largest manufacturer of aftermarket fuel injectors has discovered that, you know, these are better done in the United States. Our workers are better trained. The more complicated machines to make the fuel injectors. But anything that's sort of easy to make, they send abroad. Now, to do that kind of manufacturing, we need a well-educated workforce. And I think it comes back also to education and career training.
I got two other sides to this, too, that affect the situation. Since the Great Depression, we have now become, again, intermingled with the foreign banks to a really great extent. So we are totally dependent on the entire world economy and they on us. But we probably dictate what happens. More so than, say, we were 15 or 20 years ago. The second thing is, why don't we have more insourcing? Our tax code penalizes companies who manufacture something abroad and then invest that profit in this country. They pay an incredible tax on it. We have a business tax that's very high. It's cheaper for them to go ahead and invest in the country where they made the profit and then bring the product back. That's already taxed. But truly, the government regulations, I blame Democrats and Republicans for this one, they almost encourage outsourcing. The tax base does. We have a higher tax rate on stuff manufactured by our American companies abroad and brought back into, the money's brought back into this country. We tax it at an incredibly high rate. Nobody else does that in the world, but we do. Why? I mean, what idiots wrote that? And that was Republicans and Democrats. So some of those regulations and laws, if they were changed, might make American companies far more willing to bring their companies back and manufacture in this country. Something other than the chicken industry, for example. I mean, really, it is just, yeah, I mentioned that one because it seems sometimes that the O'Malley administration is doing all it can to drive the chicken industry off the shore. And if that happens, they won't have enough money to run the lights in here.
Well, let me ask you to follow up on this, because one of the things that's happened is we've had a series of free trade agreements. We had NAFTA in the 1990s, and now we have a series of other free trade agreements, and we've continuously pushed this idea, even though there are some countries that are still, it's very difficult to get into their markets. And this is something, by the way, the New Democrats themselves had carried forward with Bill Clinton. What kind of role do you see these free trade agreements, this emphasis upon free trade, allowing for this kind of competition that undercuts American manufacturing? Harry?
Well, yeah, that's a good question. And the only thing I'll say, I mean, it does undercut manufacturing. But the recent agreement that was signed with South Korea and two other nations, as I recall, the argument for that, and then eventually did get Senate approval, was that it was actually going to help us on jobs. We would have more jobs. There would be like 70,000 jobs, or I think more than that, that would be produced from this agreement. And I think one of the reasons it took a long time to negotiate, we've learned a little bit about negotiating these agreements, and we're a little more careful in making these agreements than we were in the past to try to make sure we don't lose, or we'll lose some, I imagine, but we don't hemorrhage jobs because of this particular agreement. And I think that happened in earlier agreements.
Dave, what do you think? I mean, the free trade agreements have been really a mainstay for Republicans.
Yeah, and again, the main thing in the way that I see, and some business people told me this, so they're not big international business, is the business tax again if they get involved with bringing the money back. It doesn't pay to invest in the United States if you're an American company. The free trade agreement doesn't help with that. It's actually a hindrance to our own manufacturing. That's sad. And again, I don't think these people did that on purpose. I think it was stupidity. I mean, some kind of a weird idea. And both parties did it, and they all sit there and say, well, I thought it'd work. You know. But hey, I remember when they said if we break up the phone company, it'll lower phone rates too. That worked real well, didn't it? I mean, I don't always believe when the government tells me that we're going to do such and such is going to fix this problem. I don't believe them. In my experience, that's not been true.
I have a question here about about says the problem in terms of our politics. It says they feel is the use of emotional issues. I guess social issues are for one. I was curious about what your observation was in terms of those kinds of utilizing those kinds of emotional issues, but also the role that money tends to play in politics. If you look at campaign contributions, for example, of congressional members, you can tell which committees they sit on. If you're on the banking committee, you get a big chunk of money from the investment in the banking firms. What kind of role do you think highly emotional issues play in politics, and how much of a role do you think the money plays in terms of campaign contributions and so on? Dave?
Well, I was at the county council meeting today, and I watched those two issues being played out, building Bennett Middle. It's for the children. Oh, my God, they've got to have a good school. And how are we going to pay for it? If we increase our debt service then will, unless the budget's going to grow, and it doesn't look like it is in Wicomico County, it looks like tax rates go up dramatically, which they can't unless tax revenues come in dramatically high, then something else has to be cut just so we can pay the interest. And it's like there's a balance there between how are we going to pay for it and, but it's for the children. And I don't know how the county council turned out on that. I had to leave before they decided.
Well, what about the idea, though, that if you contribute X number of dollars, or your PAC contributes X number of dollars to you as a local congressional member, for example, or even state legislator, you're going to be listening to them more than perhaps you might listen to somebody else unless they can demonstrate they have some kind of electoral power in your district.
Well, you know, the argument on that was always from politicians, whether they were state legislators or members of Congress, was that that money bought access in terms of, you know, they could get in and talk to a member of Congress or a state legislator. That was what they really wanted from their contributions. On the other hand, you know, access can be very important, and it certainly does help some in influence. I wouldn't deny that. Now, in terms of election, I haven't looked at this closely recently, and Dr. Hoffman could probably tell me, but many of the studies done on Congress in terms of spending money in election and winning frequently showed that, you know, it wasn't necessarily the candidate who spent the most who would win, and a lot of times it would be because they were an incumbent, you know, and they could raise more money, and it was sort of an unknown. So I think that it's a little more problematic in elections. And then you look at competitive races. Well, both sides usually can spend a lot of money, and there probably is some canceling out effect there. It's the underfunded candidate, and but those are usually the ones, you know, who need the money, but they're probably going to lose. They're probably running against in a district where they don't have much of a chance. So that in terms of money, if the question was money and winning elections in Congress, it has to be looked at carefully because there are a lot of variables.
Yeah, I'm a curmudgeon and a cynic on some of these issues, but this is one of them. I just can't believe that a PAC is giving money to anybody unless they think they're going to vote the way they want them to vote. I mean, the big money isn't out there just oh, take it, enjoy, I like the way you smile, take this money. No, they want something for it. And if they don't get it, the message is clear when they have that the contact and the chance to meet with them and right. saying, you know, we're reassessing what we're going to do for you next election. You just haven't delivered for us. Don't take that as a threat. Just want to let you know. And that was a threat. And I'm sure that goes on more than not. I'm just too cynical to believe that here's some money, and take it.
Well, we've come to the end of the hour, and I want to thank both Harry Basehart with the Democratic Party and also David Parker with the Republican Party for joining us. I'll have John come up and do the honors.
Thank you.